I'm Chris Williams, and deputy leader of the Workers' Party of Britain. In terms of Makerfield, the by-election, which is due to be held later this month, looks like it's heading for a Labour victory, or should I say, an Andy Burnham victory. He seems to be quite popular, and I don't think Reform particularly picked a particularly good candidate from their perspective. And I think Andy Burnham is seen as somebody who's done a reasonable job as the mayor, and he seems to be quite popular. He's a local lad. He did actually represent part of that area when he was previously a Labour MP, and he is a very personable individual. I mean, I like Andy. It's just that his economic prospectus, I think, is not going to be fit for purpose. He does say that he wants to. Well, Britain has been on the wrong path, I think he said, for the last 40 years, and he wants to take a different course. But he said he's going to accept the Rachel Reeves fiscal rules, which will tie both his hands behind his back and make it impossible for him to challenge the market solutions which he's been so critical of.
Yeah, well, look, I just as a casual observer, I've noticed that the Conservative Party, the Tories, do seem to sort of control everything. And when they allow a Labour government in for a while, they usually crash the economy, or at least attempt to, on the heads of the Labour Chancellor. I wonder if you think that that might be what's going on, because if you look at the figures, there's a desperate attempt right now to pretend that house prices haven't hit the highest and aren't dipping. I was just listening to the news today. They're saying, well, we think they may be not falling because, house prices seem to be so fundamental in the economy. Once they start going down, everything starts to, well, I won't say crash, but it's like a house of cards. It all starts to crumble.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily, a deliberate attempt by the Conservatives to bring down a Labour government, because the Labour government is signed up to the same economic agenda as the Conservatives, as is the.
What I'm saying is, I think that the attitude of the city and the establishment seems to be, if there's going to be a disaster, let's make sure it's on Labour's watch.
Yeah, but I mean, in reality, Tony, there's very little difference between any of the major political parties now. All of them are signed up to the same economic agenda, whether it be Labour Party, the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats, or Reform for that matter. They all are committed to a neoliberal, globalised economy. And indeed, they're all signed up as well, actually, to varying degrees, to the kind of whole imperialist foreign policy as well. So yeah, I mean, they might think that let's sort of hammer the current incarnation of the neoliberal agenda, which is currently being pursued by the so-called Labour government. But they're not really Labour. I mean, these people are about a million miles from socialism, a million miles from the sort of commitment that the Labour Party used to make and used to stand for. And back in 1974, I remember. I'm old enough to remember that, but the manifesto then that Labour put forward committed it to bringing about an irreversible shift in the balance of power and wealth in favour of working people and their families. And indeed, they were on course to do that. They were sort of pursuing an alternative economic strategy until 1976, and it all came crashing down when Harold Wilson stepped down, was replaced by Jim Callaghan, and then Jenny Seely went to the International Monetary Fund on a false premise. And brought in austerity measures as in exchange for drawing down a loan, which he actually never utilised in the end, and subsequently admitted, albeit too late. I mean, this is about 10 or 20 years later. Healey admitted that it was the wrong decision and that he was badly advised
Well, no,
by his
you just
officials.
said that Wilson resigned, and of course he did. But there are people that believe that this really was just a coup, and actually the army and the security services forced Wilson out. They were famously bugging and burgling their way around the cabinet.
Well, I mean, there was certainly a lot of pressure on Wilson, and whether indeed that forced him out or not remains to be, is left to sort of conjecture, I suppose. But there definitely was there was moves afoot to overthrow that Labour government, with a view, with a full-on coup, really, with one of the members of the royal family, Lord Mountbatten. Was apparently going to be the sort of head of state, be installed as a head of state, but I think that all kind of fell apart. But there was a serious plot to bring that about. There's no doubt about that. But And I think it was really because, you know, Labour was pursuing this alternative economic agenda, you know, with nationalisations, you know, talk about bringing back exchange, you know, exchange controls. It was not bringing them back, actually retaining the exchange controls that were scrapped by Margaret Thatcher and so on. And really bringing about, you know, an economy, as I've said, that worked for ordinary people. The sort of thing, in a way, that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn was arguing for when he became the leader of the Labour Party, when he talked about, you know, the many, not the few, and you know, that was what Labour was actually committed to doing and was implementing back then. But you know, the right wing of the Labour Party, I think, we're moving towards a, you know, a kind of monetarist economic agenda. And obviously, when Wilson stepped down, and as I've said, Healey went to the IMF, and that was used as a pretext. But I mean, what it did was pave the way for Margaret Thatcher, and then she turbocharged that agenda, and the rest is history. It's been an absolute disaster for working class communities up and down the country. Millions of jobs, 6 million roughly, you know, jobs in the manufacturing sector have gone. You know, jobs in the heavy industries have all disappeared, been
Yeah, well,
offshored.
look, I mean, that's just happening both here with Bristol Blue Glass, who haven't got a massive number of employees, but it is a world-famous company doing glass blowing here, has just had to fold because of high energy costs, high amounts of bureaucracy that they have to jump through hoops every month or whatever in order to survive, and also employee costs are very high. Maybe they could carry on if they used cheap migrant labour. I'm not sure, but I see also Denby Potteries that's been around since the 19th century having to close up in your neck of the woods, Chris.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's around, you know, using cheap migrant labour would be the solution. Far from it, in fact. I mean, what we need is an uplift in people's wages and salaries. Yeah, I mean, Denby Pottery has been around, I think, 217 years. There's going to be 600 further 600 jobs in the, you know, in the sort of ceramics industry. I mean, when you think back in the heyday, you know, there was, well, 80, 70, 80,000 people in, you know, in the potteries alone, you know, around Stoke-on-Trent. I mean, thousands, tens of thousands of those jobs that have gone. It's not that the, you know, the products aren't still needed, they are. But it's just that as a result of this kind of globalized neoliberal agenda that's been embraced by all of the major political parties, the you know, the corporations have seen that they can make more money by offshoring their operations to other countries. And that's left working class communities in the situation now where millions are in poverty and millions more are in precarious employment. I mean, nothing has come in really to replace the previously, you know, secure jobs that we enjoyed. But certainly, you know, one of the major problems that you know, Denby, for example, has encountered is the very high energy costs. And of course, what's driving that? Well, I mean, you know, it's Britain's support for NATO's proxy war in Ukraine. I mean, what we should be doing is using our good offices as the country to actually bring about peace. I mean, the war actually could have been avoided. I mean, Russia put forward a peace and security draft peace and security treaty in 2021, at the end of 2021, which all it was saying was, look, NATO should stop expanding, and Ukraine should be a neutral country, and that was just thrown out. I mean, and completely discarded. I mean, NATO was pushing for a war. I mean, there are articles in the Atlantic Council. I remember seeing one where the headline was "The Strategic Case for Risking War with Russia." Well, I mean, it's been an absolute catastrophe in terms of human life and suffering for the Ukrainian people, and also on many of the Russians who've lost their lives and been injured as well fighting this war. But in terms of the implications for us in the United Kingdom and across the West, you know, with higher energy bills and so on, and that's obviously had an impact on ordinary domestic consumers. The household bills are much more costly than they would otherwise have been because no longer are we able to access cheap Russian oil because the Nord Stream pipeline was blown up, but obviously
Well,
there was
gas
in
in that case.
that case,
We've
yeah.
also seen BP and Shell with absolutely colossal, massive record profits.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, these people are making a killing out of this system, and that's why they move heaven and earth to you know, demonize and destabilize any, you know, serious political threat to the established status quo. And unfortunately, we've got a Labour Party now which is committed to retaining that status quo. And if Andy Burnham sticks to Rachel Reeves's fiscal rule, then he's going to do exactly the
Okay,
same
well,
thing.
could you say something about what those fiscal rules are and what may be after that, what they should be?
Well, I mean, There's three things really to it. I mean, they say that according to retrograde fiscal rules, they want to ensure that spending is matched by taxation, that government's financial liabilities as a percentage of GDP should be falling after 3 years, and it also includes a cap on certain social security benefits. But what we actually need as a country is a huge fiscal stimulus, because clearly the private sector, this reliance upon the market, isn't serving the interests of ordinary people in this country. And we issue our own currency, so we can never run out of money. And what the government's focus should be on is actually identifying and building real resources in the economy, training up workers, identifying natural resources, etc., investing in, for example, agriculture, to make us self-reliant as we possibly can be. We need to be, build a resilient economy. Look, we're seeing, aren't we, these huge international crises. I've mentioned the NATO's proxy war in Ukraine. We've also seen the Israel-US attack on Iran, and that's also having significant implications in terms of the cost of living crisis. And so, we well, one, we shouldn't be participating in that sort of thing, and we should be using our efforts as a country to stop those sorts of crises from occurring. But often these things are out of our hands. I mean, we didn't participate directly, although we did, I think, on the periphery, assist with the situation in Iran and so on. But when these crises occur, we are left very, very vulnerable, very exposed, and we therefore, it seems to me, need to be doing more to make our economy more resilient and make households more resilient. I mean, one of the things that we could be doing, just one example, is the government could, as part of this big fiscal stimulus, be insulating everybody's home and business in the country. That would, at a stroke, eliminate fuel poverty in this country. There are millions of people in this country who are struggling to pay their to pay for their household energy bills. And there literally is a question often of eating or heating. I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I mean, what a state to be in when we are the fifth biggest economy in the world. Nobody should be in poverty. Nobody should be struggling in this country. We shouldn't have a housing crisis. Everybody should have a secure job and a secure retirement. We could have it with political will. It's just the political will that's lacking, because the political class in this country serve the corporate neoliberal sector, and that's just the way of the world at the moment. And we need to try and, I think, raise people's consciousness about what the reality of what's happening, and raise people's expectations. A good society is within reach. We could actually deliver that, but we just need the politicians to be put in place to make it happen.
Well, yeah, it's definitely that doesn't seem to be really happening. And someone like Jeremy Corbyn, who even though he didn't have much political acumen, had and still does have a tremendously decent heart, and someone who will stick up, for example, for the Palestinians. But I want to ask you about, look, the big change that's come with the destruction of manufacturing. I know you were from Derby, and that was also massive amounts of manufacturing going on in our cities like Bristol too, all around the country. In fact, people were concentrated in cities because there was so much work there, and in fact there was always work. If you'd found yourself unemployed, it probably you could go and knock on the door of the local factory and almost certainly just find yourself work straight away. Now that's all changed, and there's so many, many millions of people now on benefits. Some have never had permanent jobs. In fact, probably millions have been on temporary or part-time work, unreliable work, where a full-time job with job security is just like their home security, and their security of tenure is it's just being undermined. So I wonder what you make of this gentle push by some for universal basic income. I mean, rather than having to jump through hoops every week in order to get some sort of a benefit to pay the bills, but most importantly to pay the rent, to pay for food, to pay for water, these basic things. What do you make of this UBI proposal? Because there doesn't seem to be even any talk from the current Labour Party or the left much about it, even though it seems absolutely desperate. We had Alan Milburn the other week talking about how we must get these young people into jobs. Well, actually, the jobs are not there. So UBI seems to be almost the only option.
Yeah, I'm a bit skeptical about UBI, to be honest with you. I think it puts all the power in the hands of the state. And, what we should be doing, it seems to me, is to, as I've already said, a big fiscal stimulus to create jobs. I mean, it's not beyond the wit of the government to do that. We should see a huge increase, it seems to me, in the public sector. Our infrastructure is falling to pieces. We need to be investing there to address that. We've got a massive housing crisis. Our public services are in meltdown. We have a huge social care crisis in the country. So there's loads and loads and loads of things that need to be done. The market isn't going to do these things because there isn't, the money in it necessarily to make that happen. Although clearly, if there was a big investment in sorting out our infrastructure, I mean, the private sector, it would actually, in large measure, be responsible for doing a lot of that work. I mean, they would win a lot of those contracts. It wouldn't necessarily all be done by a directly employed government or local authority employees. So that's where I think we should be focused on, is actually, creating more jobs for people rather than necessarily, giving up and saying, well, let's just introduce a universal basic income. But I do think,
Well,
having
I
said
do
that,
take what you say, Chris, in that, of course, it would be very easy to cut people off from this universal basic income if they didn't behave themselves. It's also a bit Big Brother like.
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, but I do think there is a case, though, for increasing social security in this country. I mean, the social security benefits are about the most parsimonious in Western Europe. It's an outrage. I mean, our pensions are appalling. We have to work longer than most people in Europe do, and then our pensions are, a fraction of what they receive. So we need, a big uplift, I think, in social security payments. And, often it's referred to by politicians across the political spectrum. I mean, it's not really a political spectrum, as I've already said, because all basically signed up to the same thing. But they play at it really, right the way anyway, from say Labour through Reform, Conservative, Liberal, Democrat. I mean, they often refer to social security benefits as as a huge burden, a black hole, and so on. But that's just not true. Far from anything else. I mean, clearly, it should be a proper safety net, and we should be providing the resources that people need to be able to live a decent, have a decent standard of living, as it were, if they're unfortunate to be unemployed or disabled or whatever. But of course, the other thing is that when people on inevitably low incomes get a bit more money, they will spend it in the local economy. And so it's an economic driver. Actually, increasing social security is an economic driver. I mean, think about it. Look what happens when they close down these big factories and so on. Lots and lots. I mean, obviously, the people directly working in those companies lost their jobs. But they also, with that, lost their spending power. So that had a knock-on implication for all of the kind of ancillary industries that actually, used to rely on those big factories and heavy industries. In the shops and in the entertainment trade. The sort of pubs and all the rest of it, leisure facilities, etc. All ended up sort of many of them closing down altogether or scaling back their activities. And it's a similar sort of thing. Because a lot of those people then have gone on to benefit in some of those areas where no other jobs have been put in their place. So let's say it's a similar thing. I mean, when people have got that money, they will spend it in the local economy, as I say. And so, if we put more money in the pockets of people who are unemployed or disabled or whatever, unable to work for whatever reason, and then, they're going to use that money in a way that when we make a big tax cuts for the wealthy, and that's really how the economy is geared up at the moment, not just through tax cuts, but also through the whole, the bond market and everything like that. It's the people in the elites in society, the wealthy in society that benefit from that. And our whole economic agenda is geared towards maintaining that, and indeed, increasing the wealth of these characters, rather than actually serving the interests of the people, the millions and millions of people that they're supposed to be there
Well, that's
to.
right. This is the voters, by the way, which who don't
Well,
really
these are
seem
the
to
people
be
at the bottom in
included
place.
in the equation at all.
Well, they're not at all. No, of course they're not. They're not. I mean, the fact is that the political class is owned, by the big corporations
It
and.
is. I mean, they certainly have a whip hand when it comes to lobbying. Look, I wonder, could you just give us your take on what's been going on in Belfast with these riots after this Sudanese guy attacked somebody? I mean, it's difficult really to talk about the attack itself because that's going through the court process. The guy's been charged, but the reaction, the first thing I heard was that the people of the Shank Hill Road, that is to say the loyalist area in Belfast, they offered, they said, "Oh, we'll come and help." And of course, they did come and help, and various people were burnt out of their homes. This is a pretty horrendous incident that's taken place.
It's truly shocking and appalling, and my heart goes out to the people that have been affected by it. But it's another feature, isn't it, of a failing, economic system, because people's resentment, builds, understandably, when when people are short of money, when there's a housing crisis, when there are no jobs, and when the jobs that are available are often low paid or precarious, or low paid and precarious. Precarity doesn't always go with low pay, often does, but there are many people who are on reasonably good salaries, but their security is not just is kind of pretty non-existent. They can be thrown out on a whim. So those resentments do build up, and then the far right will play on that, and it's easy to other people, like migrants, to say, well, it's all their fault, which of course is an absolute nonsense. And what was also, I think, worth actually reminding people is that why are people seeking refuge in this country in the first place? Well, it's because, in large measure, of the policies that have been pursued by this government, and indeed successive governments, and all the other governments across the West, which has actually supported imperialist wars, created obviously fear and desperation, leading people to seek refuge. It's also imposed, punitive economic sanctions on countries, on with governments that they don't like, which again creates difficulties and pressure and desperation for their populations, leading to them often to seek refuge elsewhere, and also through arms sales to despotic regimes to oppress and suppress the people, which again, combines to all these things actually combine to cause that desperation
But I
and
mean,
fear.
there is also genuine economic migration going on massively across Europe. In Germany, it's been too. You know, there's been all sorts of resentment caused in, you know, by the ordinary, I suppose, middle classes in Germany, etc., saying, well, look, we just don't want all these migrants. There is an economic migrant, and the problem is here: once an economic migrant manages to make it into the European Union, that means they can come to Ireland, they can come to Northern Ireland. It's a sort of back gate into the UK, even despite the supposed border controls, which are pretty flimsy with Brexit. So there is a problem with economic migration too.
Yes, but I think what's driving the economic migration, as I've already said, is a kind of desperation which is brought about by the policies that are pursued by Western governments, including Great Britain, who's kind of been, at the front of the queue in imposing these sort of circumstances on people that actually leads to the, people to seek refuge. But look, in certain circumstances, migration is necessary. You need people to sort of, if there is a skill shortage, a labor shortage in particular areas, then migration can be very, very beneficial. But I think we have to acknowledge that that people's resentment and anxiety is a consequence of migration. But all these factors coming together, it's the UK's foreign policy which is driving the circumstances to lead people to seek refuge in the first place, and it builds resentment in the localities often where people end up settling because of the lack of investment in our
Well, I mean,
economy,
we're in
lack
a
of investment in our
situation
public
in
services.
London, for example, where over 50% of Londoners are now not born in the UK. They've come in, and obviously that is a major economic draw. People want to get work there because they're going to get more than they would in their home country.
That's true, although the sorts of scenes that we saw in Belfast don't tend to see in London, and I think that in large measure is because London does benefit. I mean, there are massive problems in London with housing costs and all the rest of it, but it does benefit. There is a disproportionate investment, public investment in London. There are many more jobs available for people in London. The infrastructure is, it gets much more investment than other parts of the country, and that needs to be addressed, it seems to me. But yeah, I mean, it's not to say there aren't problems in London. There clearly are difficulties. But I mean, look, London's a very multicultural city, and people do kind of, generally speaking, rub along, get along
Well, I
well
mean,
together.
it does seem to me that the far right likes to weaponize
Oh yes,
migration. But let's get back to Makerfield. I want to hear who do you think's gonna win? Which party?
Well, I mean, I think it's Andy Burnham's going to win. It's not necessarily the Labour Party. I think people will be voting for Andy Burnham rather than the Labour Party. I mean, Clive Lewis was on Peston was it this week or last week, and there was a bit of a a bun fight between him and Lisa Nandy, because he was saying that Labour is toxic in the constituency, but she lives up that way. She's from Wigan, isn't she? And she's a member for Wigan, and she was saying, you know, that, well, trying to claim that wasn't the case, but I think it's pretty evident that it clearly is the case. Labour is incredibly toxic. It won a massive majority at the last general election, but it was a loveless landslide. I mean, they only won that because the Tory vote was split between itself and Reform, and Labour came in through the middle with a lower vote, I think 500,000 fewer votes than Jeremy Corbyn achieved in
Well, that's
2019.
right. And it was also a big protest vote against Rishi Sunak and his
Yes,
government.
I'm
But
pretty
what
sure I
about,
don't win
why
at
can't
all.
the left get its act together and,
Well,
you know, have some sort of electoral pact where only one of the big left parties stands?
I mean, I've been arguing for that, Tony, for a long time now. I mean, I think, look, my view is let's agree where we agree and have fraternal disagreements where we don't. I mean, I think we do agree on the big issues, on the economic solutions. I mean, I think, most people on the left would say, we do need to take a bigger stake in the commanding heights of the economy. We do need to, bring the banks, to heel. We do need to, nationalize the utilities. We do need to kick the privateers out of the public sector and stop our public services being used as a cash cow, to make profits for big corporations. So, broadly, there is this huge agreement on these things, and that's where I think we need to be focused. But unfortunately, too many people on the left are obsessed with identity politics and the fallout over issues which really are peripheral to the main problems that are afflicting the country at the moment. And unless the left does get its act together, we're just going to be handing power to Reform, possibly, or a continuation
So, do you think
of a
if
Labour
Burnham
government.
does win and becomes Prime Minister, you'll be thinking about rejoining the Labour Party?
No. Well, I don't think they'd have me apart from anything else, because there's still many problems with the Labour Party. But I think, Andy, if he gets in, and it looks like he's going to win and will probably mount a challenge, and if he does, I'm pretty certain he will become the leader of the party and therefore the Prime Minister. But if he does get his hands on the keys to 10 Downing Street, he absolutely has to change the economic perspectives going forward. He can't continue to embrace the fiscal rules, the ludicrous fiscal rules that Rachel Reeves has imposed, and he can't be running scared of the bond
Well, yeah,
market.
but the indications are he's no chance of that. And I also wonder about his position on Palestine and Israel, because this seems to be, in a way, for me, it's a litmus test of all politics in the UK these days. In fact, much of the Western world is, where do you stand on Israel?
Well, Andy's, I mean, position has been appalling on that. I mean, he's been pretty tight-lipped of late in relation to the atrocities, the genocide in Gaza. I don't think he's
Yeah, he's probably
resurgent
been
as
told
something.
by his handlers, don't talk about it.
Well, possibly, but I mean, look, when he was in the House previously, he was a member of the Labour Friends of Israel. He was opposed to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. So yeah, so his foreign policy, is a lot more questionable than his domestic agenda. But I mean, I think most people out there, I mean, I agree with you in relation to the stance on Palestine is really crucial, in my opinion. It got to go to the heart of what people's politics really are. But I suppose the vast majority of the public, whilst they're very sympathetic to the Palestinian people, will also be concerned about what is going to be the domestic agenda, what is going to be the economic agenda, what's going to be the implications in terms of the cost of living crisis. And Andy's talked a good talk about going in the wrong direction for 40 years and so on, but he isn't putting forward a proposition that will enable him to deviate from that path that he said we've been the wrong path that we've been going down for the
Well, I
last
mean, I
40 years.
wonder if Britain is actually, like the United States, controlled remotely, like a sort of puppet from Israel or from Israeli sympathisers within Britain and America, that they are absolutely fine about Andy Burnham taking over because he will still continue supporting these war against Iran and against Lebanon and against Gaza and the West Bank.
Well, certainly a huge influence that Israel exerts over the political class in this country. That's absolutely no doubt. And indeed in the media as well. And they would certainly not be fearful about a Burnham-led Premiership, if he were to achieve that goal, because as you've said, he's somebody who has previously been very sympathetic to Israel, a member of the Labour Friends of Israel, and made it very clear as opposed to the BDS campaign as well. So yeah, I mean, they're not going to be too worried. That's why he's probably not had the sort of brickbats that somebody who took a different view on that question would have done. And we saw what happened to Jeremy, and we've seen in the past how they've demonized people who take a more compassionate view about and call for a sensible economic sorry sensible foreign policy to make sure that Britain is not complicit in genocide. And we're arming Israel, for God's sake. We're still sending weapons to
Well, and also
the
we hear them occasionally going over our heads here. The jets, American jets, taking off from Fairford to take part in this unprovoked illegal war against the Iran. I mean, it does seem to me. I joke on my program every week now and say, well, this is now, I think, isn't it week 15 of World War III? This American it wading into the Middle East conflict between Israel and Iran seems to me as if it's one of those forever wars that's never going to go away now.
Well, Julian Assange talked about, the forever war when the United States and Britain were engaged in the killing fields in Afghanistan. He said, the idea isn't to win the war; it's to wash public money through these killing fields and back into the coffers of the military industrial complex. And I mean, look, this has been an issue for its time immemorial. I mean, you go back, I think it was 1935, Smedley Butler, a former four-star general in the US military, wrote a book called War is a Racket. He said, and even back then, he said he'd never done any good. He'd just been really just been a hired thug for Wall Street. I mean, it always been the way. War is incredibly profitable, as he said, a racket. And, that sort of war instability, it's in Middle East and around the world, it benefits these people. These people are sociopaths, and we need to replace them. Unfortunately, they do wield a lot of power, a lot of financial power, a lot of financial muscle, and they own the political class. That's why we need to change the political class. But the first thing is getting people up to speed with the reality of what's going on. I mean,
Well,
and
look, Nigel Farage is apparently changing the political class with Reform UK, and this split-off party, Restore Britain with Rupert Lowe. What do you make of that? I mean, because if you look at the local re election results, it's quite clear Farage's party's actually support for it is dipping. I wonder why, and what you think the future is over on the right.
well, that's interesting. I mean, it seems Restore is eating into Reform's vote, and that will also help Andy Burnham in the Makefield by-election. But I'll come back to the point, though, Tony. There isn't a great deal of difference between any of the major political parties sitting in Parliament at the moment. Yes, I mean, clearly there are some differences of emphasis, and particularly in relation to the rhetoric which is used in terms of, migration and things like that. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, their economic agenda, their foreign policy agenda are virtually identical.
Well, what about the Greens? At least they're slightly different, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been some really good stuff been spoken by the leader, Zach Polanski, particularly in relation to the economy. I know a lot of people who were inspired by Jeremy Corbyn have joined the Greens, and there's a real move to push the Greens to the left. I think there is a battle going on inside the Green Party for the soul of the party between, the newcomers, the people who are more oriented towards socialism, and those are, the more kind of traditional liberal Greens that the likes of, Caroline Lucas, I suppose, typifies. And so we'll see where that turns out. But I mean, Polanski has said some good stuff on the economy. He's about the only leader really that seems to understand how the monetary system operates, and that's encouraging. But I think their foreign policy is in need of
Well,
attention. I
look,
think.
given that George Galloway seems to have been self-imposed exile or wife-imposed exile, are you going to join the Greens?
No, I'm in the no, I'm as you know a member of the Workers' Party, and quite happy to continue to try and develop support for the Workers' Party. We are still a small acorn at the moment. But I think the future really is, as we were saying earlier on, if we're going to pose a realistic challenge, the parties like the Works Party, the Green Party, and Jeremy Corbyn's Your Party, we need to find a way of collaborating. And there will be certain constituents where we will be best placed to get the positive result and win. And there'll be others where the Greens or, excuse me, your party will be. And we need to work out some sort of electoral agreement. We don't have to agree on everything. I mean, look, even people in a particular political party don't necessarily agree with every dot and comma. I don't think we should expect
Well, no,
people
that's
who are all different
healthy. That's
parties to
actually
work with.
healthy.
Yeah. So we shouldn't necessarily agree, to expect people to absolutely agree with everything who are in different
Then it
political
starts to
parties.
become a religion rather than a party.
Well, that's it. I mean, and again, a lot of it, is down to the obsession with identity politics. But also, I think that there is state actors at play who will be, in these groups and parties to foment the sort of disputatious situations that we end up in often in relation to, things like
No, well, I
voter
know.
ID
Yes,
stuff.
certainly MI5 were always very active, apparently, in the Socialist Workers' Party for many, many years,
Yeah,
which
I mean,
Mark
it's not a
Hollingsworth
conspiracy.
talked about in
Yeah,
his book.
not a conspiracy theory. I mean, we know this from the Spycop revelations. I mean, that just scratched the surface of it. So we know, what the state does. And as I've already said, it's in the interests of the very powerful movers and shakers
I mean, it's a bit like
in
Grenfell
maintaining
Tower.
status quo.
Still, nobody called to account. Anyway, look, finally, Chris. It sounds to me like you're saying Andy Burnham is probably going to win. He will most certainly or likely take over as Prime Minister, but there won't be any change at all.
Well, I think there'll be some tinkering, but it needs more than tinkering. I think maybe, Andy's instincts on the domestic agenda are probably genuine. I'd like to think they were. I mean, I like Andy. I know Andy from when I was an MP previously, and he seems like a decent sort of guy. It's just his politics is a bit with where it ought to be, I think. And I think he will genuinely want to try and, certainly on the domestic front anyway, say his foreign policy is another question. But on the domestic front, I think he genuinely would want to try and do things a bit differently. But he won't be able to do that, as I keep saying, if he sticks to the fiscal rules and if he's frightened to death of the bond market. We need a bold ambition, really, a bit like what we did in 1945. He needs to rediscover that spirit of 1945. I mean, and that was a radical government too. I think could have done more, but they did a pretty good job, I
Well,
think,
they
on the
also
domestic
knew how
front.
to discipline the Bank of England. And it's funny you mention that because I was just walking along some of the coastline here around the Bristol Channel and I saw 1947 implanted into all of the new flood defences that have been built. And this is supposedly in a country that had been smashed to pieces, was trying to pick itself up after World War II with bomb sites all over the place. So if they can do it then, surely we can do it now.
Of course we can. I mean, of course we can. I mean, it's just about political will, and there was a real determination then, I think, to not go back to the circumstances that the people like my mum and dad's generation had to endure. And of course, the other thing was that there were millions of people being demobilized from the military who had been politicized and weren't going to go back to the 1930s. And there was a really, very real fear, I think, of a revolution. And there's all these millions of people being demobbed who knew about military discipline, knew how to use a weapon, and don't forget the Russian Revolution, wasn't that long before that. I mean, 20 years or so before the end of the Second World War. So I think there's a real fear that unless there were these social reforms, it could very well have been a revolution in this country. But even that Labour government, though, as I've said, I think it could have done more on the domestic front, but it didn't do a bad job. And we set in train that post-war consensus. His foreign policy, though, was pretty crap. It's got to be said. So it was a bit like, with Andy Burnham, really, as I say, his foreign policy, is not good at all. But people can change. I mean, I hope you will reflect on that. He said he's changed from his period as previous minister and so on. I think he's recognized now that if he's true of what he's saying about, we've been on the wrong path for 40 years. Of course, he was part of keeping the country on that path when he was in the new
Yeah, well,
Labour
it's warm
administration.
words, so let's just see. I mean, people do say this sometimes when especially when they've got their eye on the main chance. Anyway, Chris Williamson, can you just tell us whereabouts people can find and follow you online?
Yeah, I mean, follow me on social media. I'm at Darby Chris W on X, or formerly Twitter, and I'm also on Facebook under my name, Chris Williamson.
Okay, Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
All the best. Cheers.